Good morning. This is Frank Riccio on your host for Talking About the Law. And with me is Attorney Ralph Sprogna from the Worcester area. And what we're going to do is we're going to continue our program. Ralph, you talked about the tribunal system. And could you just explain and elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, the tribunal system was born out of a perceived crisis several years ago by the legislature concerning medical malpractice claims. It was an attempt to eliminate frivolous claims that were being brought against medical providers. And what the legislation instituted was a so-called medical malpractice tribunal, so that presently, every time a claim is filed alleging medical malpractice, the court then convenes a three-person panel known as the tribunal, generally made up of a physician of the same specialty as the one that's being complained against in the lawsuit, a superior court judge, and a local lawyer. That panel hears the basis of the claim and passes on the claim if it has merit, and from that point forward the claim would proceed through the court system. If the plaintiff does or the patient does not prevail at the tribunal level, then in order to proceed through the court system, the plaintiff must post a bond to defray the defendant's expenses as the litigation proceeds.
Now you hear a lot of talk about frivolous lawsuits, and especially in the medical negligence and medical malpractice area. But, you know, you and I are both experienced trial lawyers, and we do a lot of medical malpractice cases. Are there really any frivolous lawsuits being brought against doctors or healthcare providers?
Practically, I don't believe that there are, because the economics of this kind of practice are such that it's very expensive to bring these cases. The expert witnesses that I've spoken about are not cheap. There are instances where I've paid $25,000 for a doctor to review a claim and come to court to testify. They also involve a lot of work. And the practicality of that is that cases that do not have any merit are simply not brought because of the economics in bringing them.
And they're very well defended. You know, most of the lawyers who defend these cases are experienced. They come from very good law schools, top of their class, the insurance companies will pay spare no money to hire these people. Has that been your experience?
Yes. I typically tend to see the same attorneys all the time. The attorneys that defend these cases, much like the attorneys that prosecute them, tend to do these kinds of cases and nothing else. So they're very experienced, they're very competent, and they're worthy adversaries.
You know, I have to say, honestly, Frank, the fact is you're too you don't say enough about yourself is a general rule, because you and Ralph are at the top of the class when it comes to background training, education, and experience. You're actually you were a practicing licensed dentist, top-notch dental school, top-notch law schools and college. And Ralph's the same way, although I don't think you're a dentist or a healthcare provider, Ralph.
No, I'm not, actually.
And the fact is, these medical cases are defended by experts, you know, really good ones. But there are guys like you and Ralph out there who, you know, are representing people injured by, you know, by medical error, and they need you.
Well, thank you. And Ralph, would you agree with me that most of these medical cases are really, in a sense, consumer cases as well, in terms of helping people to, you know, get through and get good health care?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the whole premise and justification, if you will, for our system of justice, that if plaintiff's lawyers did not exist, going back to my early days when we were handling cases involving flammable fabrics, exploding gas tanks, and other dangerous products, these cases, this litigation does have a social value. It has a social impact because once the manufacturers, once the physicians, once the healthcare providers start having to pay money for their mistakes, it changes their conduct and hopefully for the better.
And in getting back to the consumer aspect of medical malpractice, how does your office typically handle fees? In other words, the lawyers have to be paid for their work. How is that done?
We work, as you know, on what is called a contingency fee basis, which means that the consumer, or the patient, does not pay anything for the legal services unless there's a recovery on behalf of the patient, either by settlement or by verdict. As part of this medical malpractice legislation several years ago, from which the Medical Malpractice Tribunal evolved, part of that legislation also mandated and dictated the form of fee agreement that must be used in these cases. It's been approved by our Supreme Judicial Court. And what that provides is basically a sliding scale, so that if, as the amount of recovery increases to the patient, the percentage of the fee actually decreases. On average, in the cases that we've handled, the percentage contingency generally is around 28 or 29% of the gross recovery.
Now, you've gone through a screening process. You've got an expert who will support your case. What is the next step in terms of going forward? Do you immediately accept the case, or do you do more diligence and more work to make sure that you do have a case that's going to be viable through the court system?
Our practice is that we have a pretty good idea at the time that we send the cases, the medical records and the history and chronology out to the expert, that it's something worth taking a look at. After that, if we get a positive reply from the expert in written form that says, I've reviewed these records, I'm familiar with this area of medicine, and in my opinion, this physician, Dr. X, did not meet the standard of care, then at that point, we are pretty much committed to file the lawsuit. Once the lawsuit is filed, through this tribunal process, we, as part of the submission to the tribunal, have a written letter or report from the expert witness stating that the particular defendant who was being charged did not comply with the standard of care. And in my experience, Frank, as you know, if you have that kind of written opinion and submit it to the tribunal, they have no discretion whatsoever. They must pass your case, and from there on in, the case proceeds through the court system.
Now, as you know, and as I know in doing these cases, you may have an expert who will tell you that you have negligence, but that in and of itself is not enough. You also have to prove another aspect of the case, which is called causation. Could you explain that?
Yes. The example I give clients that I interview who are trying to get their arms around how this whole process works is I tell them there are basically three elements of the case. You must first show negligence, which is a deviation from the so-called standard of care, and then this element of causation. And the example I give people is if a woman has a lump in her breast and she goes to her the doctor for her yearly mammogram, and they discover a lump in her breast, and she's concerned about it and says to her doctor, well, I'd like to get that tested. And the doctor says, well, you're too young. There's no history in your family. Don't worry about it. I think it's a benign fatty mass. It's not anything to worry about. She then goes home in this example and talks to her husband and says, you know, I went to my doctor today. He found a lump on my breast, but he said it's not anything to worry about it. But I think I'm going to get a second opinion. So she then goes off on her own and goes to doctor number two, and he says the same thing. Look, it's probably nothing, but I'm going to biopsy it. So the second doctor does an aspiration or a needle biopsy, and lo and behold, they find that it is cancerous. Well, in that instance, the first doctor may be guilty of negligence or not complying with the standard of care, because the woman should have had a biopsy from him, but the damage does not flow from that because the delay in treatment of a couple of days during which this woman gets her second opinion is not enough to damage her in terms of having her cancer progress more and more harmfully over just a two-day period. In that example, if the woman does not get the second opinion and goes back a year later and finds that she's got cancer, well, the year delay could be significant and therefore may have caused the cancer to progress to a later, more dangerous stage with a more dangerous or harmful prognosis in terms of the spread of the cancer.
It looks like, as we all know about the U.S. Constitution, there are checks and balances in our government, and it looks like in terms of taking on a medical malpractice case, we're starting to see develop here a pattern of checks and balances. In other words, it just isn't someone saying, I've been harmed by a doctor, therefore I'm going to file a lawsuit. There's much more involved in actually taking it through the legal system. And I take that. So when we come back, what we're going to do is we're going to continue on the process and how a medical malpractice case weaves its way through the system. Thank you.